From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. If you open up social media today, you might be seeing a lot of the color black as Americans use platforms like Facebook and Instagram to stand with the protesters using a hashtag Blackout Tuesday.
The White House Twitter account, meanwhile, posted a produced video documenting the president's response soon after he said this in the Rose Garden.
I am your president of law and order and an ally of all peaceful protesters. But in recent days, our nation has been gripped by professional anarchists, violent mobs, arsonists, looters, criminals, rioters, Antifa, and others.
As the president spoke, National Guard troops were breaking up peaceful protests outside of the White House. The president then walked to the historic but boarded up St. John's Church, known as the Church of Presidents, to have his photo taken holding a Bible. Joining us now for more is NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. And Mara, President Trump was wildly criticized for standing in front of that church, including by the Episcopal Bishop of D.C., who called it a charade. What was the president trying to achieve, and do you think he achieved it in that moment when he gave those statements?
I think what he was trying to achieve was send a message to his base that he, as you just heard him say, is the president of law and order. He also said that he was dispatching thousands and thousands of heavily armed soldiers in D.C. So the message was about cracking down, not calming down. He did say he wanted justice for George Floyd and his family, but that was just one sentence. He didn't say exactly how he wants to go about that, whether it's prosecuting the police officers or setting up a task force on racism in police departments. The speech was very militaristic. There have been some polling that showed that his base was slipping, and he went back to one of his core messages about law and order. And he ran on this in 2016. The unrest in Ferguson and Baltimore helped him win, and I think he thinks it's going to help him again.
That threat to send the military into states that don't control protesters, there's a lot of debate about whether he can actually do that or should he do that. Is that likely to happen?
Well, he can do it. Whether he will do it is another question. He said yesterday that he strongly recommends that every governor deploy the National Guard. A lot of governors have already deployed the National Guard. Then he said that if you don't establish an overwhelming law enforcement presence, I will deploy the U.S. military and solve the problem. Now, this is a little bit reminiscent of his stance during the pandemic, which is I have total authority, but the governors have total responsibility. I don't think that the president will federalize the National Guard. If he does that, then he's responsible for quelling the unrest all over the country. But I think that he absolutely can. There's something called the Insurrection Act, which allows him to federalize the National Guard. It's been used before in 1992 after the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles. But at that time, it was California elected officials, the mayor of Los Angeles, who requested that the U.S. military help.
Yeah. Joe Biden gave a speech today in Philadelphia, ripping into the president's response to the protests. What was his message, and how do you expect this issue to play out on the campaign over the next several months?
Well, I think this issue will be a big one in the campaign. Of course, that how big depends on how long the protests go on, how long the riots go on. But Joe Biden has been struggling to get some airtime. The president has dominated the media narrative, and Joe Biden is presenting himself as the polar opposite of the president, that he's someone who will heal the nation. He will deal with these systemic problems. Don't forget, what gave rise to these riots was a kind of triple whammy of the pandemic has hit African-American communities harder than any other. The unemployment and the recession has hit African-American communities harder than any other. And now these instances of police brutality. So young African-American men ages 18 to 25 who've been sitting home, cooped up, locked down for the last couple of months, they haven't been teleworking. You know, they've been suffering from each one of these problems, and it was a recipe for violence. And Joe Biden says, I can fix these problems. Donald Trump isn't even addressing them.
That's Mara Liasson. She's national political correspondent for NPR. Mara, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
George Floyd's family is planning to march with community leaders in Houston today. Floyd was a Christian who was involved in mentoring young men in the city's Third Ward before moving to Minnesota a couple years ago. His funeral is set for a week from today in Houston. Joining us now is Patrick Anguolo, lead pastor at Resurrection Houston. He plans to march today. Pastor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and our condolences to you. I know it's been just over a week since your friend died at the hands of police in Minneapolis. What's on your mind today as you and your local community get ready to march for George Floyd?
I think before we can get to the repentance of racism as a country, we want to lament and grieve and process through the pain, but then also the celebration of the life of somebody who meant so much to so many people. I didn't know the full scope of the influence that he had outside of our particular community, but man, just the outpour of support from people all across the country, it looks like he meant a lot to a lot of people.
What do you remember about him? You've known him for years now.
I remember him being a gentle giant, being protective. When I first started to do ministry in the CUNY Homes housing project, I needed allies and particularly somebody who could open doors and serve as a gateway to meeting other people. I could knock on 50 doors and maybe 50 people answer. He can come out of the house and 100 people would come out of the house. He had that type of influence. And for him to be so high, and I remember his hospitality, for him to be so hospitable to the work that we were doing, and then to let the community know in seen and unseen ways that we were okay. We are not to be suspicious of us, that we mean well, even if we bump into, you know, things we may not know of.
What would he think, do you think, of these large protests across the country, some that have turned violent?
I think he would be first empathetic with the fact that people are tired of every 2 weeks a new hashtag. But he would probably also, while understanding, also want to make sure that a constructive, active, nonviolent movement that, and however long it takes, that would see that justice would be done, not only in his case, but that there is a fundamental overhaul of what we call the white supremacist machine, that there is some type of repentance in these not yet to be United States from the sin of racism.
You've said that what we're seeing now when it comes to the reaction to George Floyd's death will knock Rodney King out of the water. What did you mean by that?
So I think we're at an inflection point in our nation's history. And I think George's death serves as that inflection point, that either, in the words of the scripture, we're going to master this sin of racism, or it's going to master our country. Those fault lines have been there since the country's inception, and I just think it's coming to a head. You hear the climate from well-meaning people from all parts of the ethnic spectrum who are tired one way or another, and they want to see something new happen. And in the words of King, I think we're either moving towards chaos or we're moving towards the beloved community.
Well, and what did you think of what we all saw last night with the president clearing out the protesters with National Guard troops away from the White House with tear gas, peaceful protesters moved away so that he could go across the street to a church and hold a Bible up for the cameras?
Well, I must admit, I am not a Democrat or Republican. I'm a theocrat. And so, of course, I love the Bible and God's word, but what I saw was a mocking of God. And I just think that too often in this country, we've wrapped Christianity in the flag and have called it Christianity. And I think, man, the church has to stand up in its prophetic role to stand outside of power and say, man, President Trump, we pray for you, but what you did was wrong. You used God, his name, his word. You took it in vain, and you used his word to enact violence, state-sponsored violence on people who were citizens. And so, man, we would just call the president himself to repentance.
That is Patrick Ngwolo, who is the lead pastor at Resurrection Houston. He knew George Floyd and will be marching today in his honor. Thank you so much for joining us, Pastor.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Like many Native American communities, two tribes that share the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming have been hit hard by the coronavirus. More than 200 cases have been reported there, and seven tribal members have died after testing positive for COVID-19. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr reports that the number of infections is growing despite the tribe's rigorous efforts to keep the virus off the reservation.
For the past 140 years, the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes have both called the Wind River Valley in central Wyoming home. They didn't choose to share this reservation. The federal government forced the historically warring tribes together in the late 19th century. And unlike most tribes with shared territory, the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho govern their citizens separately. But since the start of the pandemic, they've been on the same page about one thing.
We had to try to jump out ahead of this and protect our people.
That's Stephen Fasthorse with the Northern Arapaho Business Council. He says when it comes to COVID-19, Native people are especially at risk, with high rates of underlying conditions like diabetes and heart disease. Fasthorse blames the federal government for underfunding the Indian Health Service.
As far as the chronic diseases that a lot of our tribal members face, even before this pandemic, the lack of healthcare systems on the reservation. With all those factors, we had to keep this from turning into a widespread wildfire on the reservation.
So the two tribes issued a joint stay-at-home order. There was never any such statewide restriction in Wyoming, but tribal members have been on lockdown since the 1st of April. They face court fines and even jail time if they leave their homes for non-essential purposes. Dr. Paul Ebert runs the Northern Arapaho Tribe's clinic. He says this strict order is coupled with an aggressive medical strategy.
We decided early on that testing was going to be very important.
Since mid-March, they've tested thousands of people from both tribes. The clinic's testing numbers hover around 30% of all the tests conducted in Wyoming.
Over half of our cases are people who were asymptomatic. These are people who would not have been tested in the county or other places in the state.
The tribes are so far ahead of the curve that some non-natives in the area have been wanting to come to the tribal clinic to get tested. But the Northern Arapaho tribe is footing the bill in the middle of a budget crisis that faces both tribes. Their casinos are closed, their oil and gas revenues have taken a nosedive, and unlike state and local governments, they don't have a tax base to fall back on. Co-chairwoman Karen Snyder of the Eastern Shoshone Business Council says that means cuts to vital social services when they're needed most.
We know that there's a lot of tribal members that are going without.
She says the tribes have gotten pretty creative in helping their members stay afloat.
And hoping to provide some immediate relief for this, we opened up a special hunting season. We did have a volunteer group with the Shoshone tribe, and just hats off to those individuals. They had volunteered to go out and hunt for our elders.
Both tribes have also been hosting food and supply distributions on the reservation. And with overcrowding a persistent problem on Wind River, they're providing quarantine housing for those who test positive and want to stay isolated from family.
We do everything that we can to keep them home, to keep them safe, to keep them sheltered in whatever it is that we need to do and keep them healthy for the most part.
Still, Wind River has lost community members. Native people account for 7 of Wyoming's 17 confirmed COVID-19 related deaths. State Representative Andy Clifford, whose district covers much of the reservation, says the deaths have already hit her constituents hard.
The sense of urgency for us as tribal people, as Indigenous people, to take care of our people. One death was one too many for us.
Clifford says the stay-at-home order and mass testing on the reservation will prevent more tragedy. But there's been one ugly consequence to this approach. More testing means a higher rate of confirmed COVID-19 cases on the reservation, and Clifford says some border town residents have been twisting that data and blaming Native people for the spread of the disease.
These racist comments and actions were going to occur. It's just a matter of when. And unfortunately, it started because of the deaths, which is just unfortunate, but it doesn't surprise me.
Clifford says she isn't surprised that her constituents are largely abiding the stay-at-home order. She believes they're comfortable making a sacrifice on behalf of the community. For Here and Now, I'm Savannah Marr.
And Savannah's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau and America Amplified.
The coronavirus has at least temporarily destroyed the airline industry and the hotel industry, but it turns out many people are flocking to RV dealers looking for an alternative way to travel that allows for social distancing. Joining us now is Lori Rackle, former travel editor for the Chicago Tribune, who's been following this. Lori, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And what's going on with RVs right now? What are you hearing?
Well, you know, the travel industry, it's no secret, has been hammered by the coronavirus. You know, hotels are dark, theme parks are empty, cruise ships, that's not even an option for many people anymore. So the one bright spot has been RVs. The RV industry is actually seeing quite an uptick in demand. As people are looking for ways to get out of the house and still travel, but do it in more of a what's perceived as a safer, more controlled environment.
And what kind of RVs are people buying or renting?
It's pretty much RVs, you know, encapsulates a very broad range of recreational vehicles. It can be everything from your little pop-up camper that you tow behind your SUV to like big Class A motorhomes that look like buses and can cost $500,000. So you're seeing a lot of interest on a lot of entry level people. So they're going to gear more towards the rentals or the trailer campers. So a lot of the towables are seeing a big increase in demand, and RV rentals with places like RV Share, which you can think of that as like an Airbnb for RV rentals, peer to peer rental sites. They are reporting a huge increase in demand. So a lot of people are trying to like test it out, see if they like it and if it's a lifestyle for them.
Well, and I was talking to a friend just anecdotally who was looking into renting an RV for a summer trip and said he couldn't find any.
Oh, yeah. No, you're hearing a lot of dealers saying that, you know, there's a lot of pent up demand. A lot of the retailers had to close during the pandemic. So you're seeing a lot of a big rush. A lot of people are. And then you've got your first time entrants into the market who are also increasing demand. And then you had a lot of these manufacturers that had to close down during the pandemic. So the supply, I mean, the shipments of RVs in April was down considerably, considering, you know, April of 2019 to April of 2020. It dropped a lot. So there was less supply. Increased demand. So yeah, you're seeing some shortages, but a lot of the people in the industry are very bullish that the manufacturers will be able to ramp up and meet whatever demand increases. If it's sustainable over the next few months and demand continues to stay high, the RV manufacturers should be able to meet that demand.
Well, what are you hearing from people who are either buying or renting RVs about their travel plans?
Well, when you're looking at surveys from like when people are trying to see where people want to go, people do not feel safe flying anymore, and they do feel safest in a personal vehicle, which an RV can double as your personal vehicle, right? You can control your environment. You can limit the hotels you have to. You don't have to go to hotels. You can limit the mm-hmm. restaurants you have to go to. You can bring your food with you. So people like that. They can also pivot, right? So if there's an outbreak somewhere, if they have to change their plans, you basically point the thing in the other direction. So there's a lot of flexibility that comes with it. You know, somebody I interviewed for my story, this was like a world traveler. She's been on African safaris. She's been flown all over the place. She never, ever thought she'd set foot in an RV. It just wasn't her jam. But this situation forced her in late April to get an RV so she could drive her daughter back out to college, pick up her parents who were stranded in Florida. And she turned out loving it. And she's like, I think I'm going to go use it to see national parks. And a lot of people do want to go to national parks. We know that from surveys, too. They want to be out in the outdoors and they want to socially distance. And RVs are kind of, they're tailor-made for that type of travel.
Now, are people actually going to the RV dealerships in person or are mostly doing this online?
There was a big increase in online sales with Camping World Holdings. They're a huge retailer of RVs and RV services, and they had a big jump in online sales, which actually caused their stock price to surge. But now as more showrooms are opening up too, you are getting a lot of dealers are reporting increased foot traffic in the showrooms because people want to be able to, you know, see and check it out and walk inside one and see what's best suited to them. So as more and more retailers open up, as the shelter in place orders start to loosen, I imagine you're going to see a lot more in-person dealings.
So if you were to go and rent an RV after doing this reporting about this, where would you take it? What would be the ideal itinerary?
Funny you should ask, because I'm actually thinking about doing just that.
Oh, wow.
I would like to head out west and hit a lot of the national parks in Utah and Colorado and just kind of take my time and make my way and see those things that, you know, I wasn't able to do before because of my work schedule. And just, you know, that's the beauty of the RV is that you can, you know, if you find out about another place that you want to go check out, you can easily alternate that as opposed to getting, you know, locking into airline reservations or a, you know, a theme park or a cruise or something like that. The RV gives you so much flexibility that it's kind of like if you wind up really liking the mountains of Colorado, you stay there longer. If you want to then, you know, head down to Arizona, you can do that. So, and a lot of people are able to work remotely now. We're more comfortable with that notion. So one of the dealers I talked to thinks that there's going to be a lot of people who might hit the road and kind of take their office with them for a little bit so they can do a little bit of sightseeing on the weekend and, you know, work remotely from their RV during the week.
It sounds like you're not the only one who wanted to go to the national parks, by the way, because Arches National Park opened last Friday at 6 a.m. And within 3 hours, the National Park Service said that the park was at capacity. I guess a lot of people have this idea.
Absolutely. Yeah. The survey that I was referring to earlier, the number one place that people wanted to go was parks and then followed by beaches. Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly people just want to be outside.
That is Lori Rackel, who's a former travel editor for the Chicago Tribune. We'll link you to her story about the growing demand in the RV industry at hereandnow.org. Lori, thank you.
Thank you.
Some senior Facebook employees are staging a revolt against CEO Mark Zuckerberg's decision to leave up posts by President Trump that Twitter flagged for glorifying violence. Last week, Trump tweeted that when the looting starts, the shooting starts, in response to the civil unrest following the death of George Floyd in police custody. Twitter took the extraordinary step of hiding that post under a warning label. Yesterday, Facebook employees staged a virtual walkout to protest Facebook's decision not to do the same. Let's bring in Casey Newton. He's Silicon Valley editor for The Verge. And Casey, how much backlash is Zuckerberg facing right now?
Yeah, so the question here is, what is the red line, if any, that Trump cannot cross on Facebook that would get the company to take down one of his posts? And I think it's fair to say that this decision to leave up the Trump posts that use that language is one of the most controversial content moderation decisions in the company's history. And it actually led to about 400 Facebook employees staging a virtual walkout yesterday. So it's very controversial.
You obtained audio from a meeting Zuckerberg had with employees about this decision. What did he say in defense of this hands-off approach?
Well, I mean, the first thing he said was that it was a hard call to make. He's not suggesting it's easy, but what he says is Facebook's policies have always allowed for a state to announce that it was considering taking violent action. And the rationale is that if one country is going to bomb another and you live in that other country, you have a right to know that you might be in danger. But what he told employees was that they actually hadn't considered the idea that a leader would use violence against their own people and sort of threaten it in advance on their platform. And so now they're going to have to go kind of rethink that based on how Trump is using Facebook.
Do you see any circumstance that would change Zuckerberg's mind on this overall issue, or is he basically established that really anything is okay as long as it comes from a public official?
So I've been asking people at Facebook this, and one thing they said to me was Facebook actually did remove some political ads from the Trump campaign earlier based on some misinformation that they contained about voting. But I think there's a difference between taking down a campaign ad and taking down speech from the president. It's something that these companies just frankly never contemplated that they would be in a position of even having to consider. There will be significant blowback if they take action, as we saw when Trump signed that executive order last week. So I think they're going to continue to try to avoid having to make the call. But I also think that there are some real red lines that the president won't be allowed to cross.
You know, President Trump's campaign reaches, as you mentioned, a lot of people through Facebook, and articles from conservative news sites actually frequently dominate the list of most shared stories on Facebook. Is there a political calculation President Trump is making by going after Twitter and not Facebook?
I think that the president would just as happily go after Facebook if he thought that his, words were being censored there. And in fact, he has been critical of Facebook in the past. I think anytime one of these tech companies that he uses as a broadcast platform challenges him in any way, he's going to go after them.
That's Casey Newton, Silicon Valley editor for The Verge. Casey, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
The scenes in cities across America over the last several days have reminded some people of the tension and unrest that occurred in the late 1960s, when riots and violence erupted in cities and left a mark on them for decades. Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and joins us now. Julian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And not everyone thinks comparing 2020 to 1967-68 is accurate. What do you think?
Well, I think it's fair. I think there are certain recurring issues that we saw in 68 and we're seeing in 220, like institutional racism and the politics of that issue, street protest, as well as politicians capitalizing on a white backlash. I would argue, and I have, that it's actually worse today in many ways because of the pandemic and the instability in the White House. But I think there's a lot of lessons to be drawn from that period.
All right, well, take us back to the summer of 1967 when riots broke out in Newark and Detroit and more than 150 cities around the country. And then in 68, when riots erupted again after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, what was going on to spark all of that?
Well, Lyndon Johnson, the president, actually put together a commission, the Kerner Commission, that asked that exact question. What was going on in 1967? And what they found that in each of these cities, there were certain chronic problems such as unemployment and a lack of opportunity that had been building frustration in these areas. But ultimately, one of the biggest issues was policing. And police interaction with African Americans was a source of frustration. And many residents felt they were constantly being harassed and attacked by the people meant to protect them. And often it was an arrest that sparked the riots. That's exactly what happened in Detroit and Michigan and New York.
Well, and in July of 1967, President Johnson gave a televised address to the country and said federal troops and police action cannot create lasting peace in our cities. Listen.
The only genuine long-range solution for what has happened lies in an attack mounted at every level upon the conditions that breed despair and breed violence.
Now, in that address, he began talking about restoring order, but went on to talk about the problems causing the riots. What was the political response to the tension and the anger erupting across the country?
Well, the political response worked against Lyndon Johnson. It moved the country to the right. Republicans and Southern Democrats and more conservative Northern Democrats. In both parties, many politicians capitalized on the anger that emerged toward the rioting. It became a way to talk about why civil rights legislation wasn't working or why the war on poverty wasn't working. And it became a really important talking point for conservatives, meaning the riots, in the buildup to the 1968 election. So Johnson was frustrated, not just because they were happening, but he understood it was totally eroding his political support for the kinds of domestic programs he still wanted to pass.
And Johnson did not run for re-election in 1968, in part because of what was going on with the Vietnam War, as we've talked about. But Richard Nixon did win that election. And I want to listen to what he said when he was giving his acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention in 1968.
When the nation with the greatest tradition of the rule of law is plagued by unprecedented lawlessness, when a nation has been known for a century for equality of opportunity is torn by unprecedented racial violence, and when the President of the United States cannot travel abroad or to any major city at home without fear of a hostile demonstration, then it's time for new leadership for the United States of America.
Now, that will probably remind people right now of what President Trump has been saying about law and order. Do you see a connection there between Trump saying law and order and Richard Nixon winning in part on a campaign of restoring law and order?
It was very important to Richard Nixon's campaign, talking about law and order, appealing to the silent majority, which is a term that President Trump tweeted out, was a way to unite his coalition and to paint progressive movements that had been fighting for social rights throughout the 1960s as extremists and as a danger to the country more broadly. It worked very well for Nixon in 68. It was essential to his victory. Trump has a different challenge because he's president. He's not an outsider. He's actually the one in charge. So if there's no law and order, he's responsible for the breakdown of law and order, and that's what you're going to hear from Democrats. But it is a powerful argument, and I think it might be one of the defining themes that we hear in the Republican campaign for 2020.
Well, and we've already heard more of it from President Trump just in the last day. Let's listen here. He called for governors to crack down more severely on protesters and looters. Here he is yesterday on a conference call with the governors, this sound courtesy of The Washington Post.
And a lot of men, we have all the men and women that you need, but people aren't calling them up. You have to dominate. If you don't dominate, you're wasting your time. They're going to run over you. You're going to look like a bunch of jerks.
That was the president talking to the governors. Now, he did announce yesterday that he's going to use the Insurrection Act of 1807 to allow the military to be used on U.S. soil to quell some of these protests. What are your thoughts on that as an historian?
Well, I think we're reaching a pretty dangerous point. I think there's ways in which he can use that in this situation, and I think he will do that. We've seen it invoked several times, including after the acquittal of the police who attacked Rodney King. It's controversial. Many governors won't want him to do this. The biggest danger is that he does this, and it leads to bloody confrontations, and it sparks more disorder in the country. But I think that's the direction he is going in terms of invoking executive authority in this way. We'll see. We'll see what the governors do. We'll see what kind of challenges mount. That's the kind of signals he's sending.
Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee, addressed the situation in a speech today in Philadelphia. Let's listen.
It's been our purpose in the very beginning to become a nation where all men and women are not only created equal, but they're treated equally. Not just created equal, but treated equally. To become a nation defined in Dr. King's words, not only by the absence of tension, but by the presence of justice.
Julian, what do you make of Biden's message at this moment? He is 77 years old. He, of course, remembers the civil rights struggles of the 1960s very well.
I think it's a good message, and I think it's one that Democrats would do well to focus on, meaning rather than talking about riots and disorder, focus on the issues that are at the heart of the protest and mostly peaceful protest, criminal justice and racial equality, and the idea that an African-American should not be scared to walk the streets and scared of being killed at the hands of a police officer for not doing anything. And I think Democrats should play to hope, even if President Trump is playing to fear. That's the other legacy of the 1960s. It was the Johnson of 1964 and 65 that said the federal government must address racial inequality and injustice rather than run away from it.
Julian, let me just finally go back to where we started, comparing what's happening now to what happened in the 1960s. Now, we mentioned Martin Luther King Jr. was shot and killed in April of 68. Just 2 months later, Bobby Kennedy was shot and killed. How do you make sense of the divisions now? Are we as divided of a nation as we were then?
Well, yeah, I think over these questions of institutional racism, they were never resolved. And so the divisions that unfolded in the 60s about these questions continue through today, because after desegregation and after voting rights, we never really tackled these other kinds of questions, such as policing and criminal justice. So we're still divided over the issues opened up in the 60s. But layered over that, we're just more politically polarized today. The parties are farther apart, not just on big issues, but on the most minor issues. So the added challenge now is finding any possibility for bipartisan action in Washington. And that's what makes the fault lines of 220 so much scarier in some ways than what they were in 68 when they were already pretty bad.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Thanks, as always.
Thanks for having me.
When you look at photos of protests over George Floyd's death, you'll see big crowds, people standing close together, some hugging or locking arms, and many, but not all, wearing face masks. That has many officials concerned about a possible increase in coronavirus cases after the protests. Dr. Seema Yasmin is a clinical assistant professor of medicine at Stanford University, a public health physician, and author of the forthcoming book, Viral BS, Medical Myths and Why We Fall for Them. And she joins us to look at the intersection of this pandemic and the protests. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes. So, Dr. Yasmin, Minnesota's Governor Tim Walz has said he thinks the state will actually see a spike in COVID-19 cases after these protests. And we've heard other officials agree with this statement. Are you concerned protesters are putting themselves at risk?
So I think it's really important that we remember that the protests are against police brutality and racism, and that these two issues are completely connected to the viral pandemic. COVID-19 is not the great equalizer, as some people have said. The virus is killing Black people in America at more than twice the rate of white people. And in some places like Kansas, the death rate from COVID-19 is 7 times higher in Black people. So racism is a public health issue. Racism is a medical problem. Racism literally causes accelerated aging in the cells of Black people. So when we talk about the pandemic right now, the Black community in America is hit with not one pandemic, but two pandemics, COVID-19 and the chronic problems of racism and police violence. And even the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, have issued statements to this effect, that there is systemic racism, this is a public health issue. So I say this because those who are outraged that protesting racism endangers our collective safety fail to understand that America has never been safe for Black people, and that if nothing changes, it will remain an unsafe place after the pandemic. And protesters in many places have been wearing masks, some wearing goggles, some at sit-in protests and marches are sticking to small groups and practicing physical distancing. But unfortunately, we've seen video footage from over the weekend of police officers snatching masks off the faces of protesters, corralling and confining them so they end up packed together and aren't able to do physical distancing. And my concern is that that kind of policing could cause an increase in cases.
Oh, that's really interesting. So the police officers' actions in getting people to be in concentrated groups, you're saying, actually increase that risk. Is there a way to demonstrate more safely right now? I'm thinking about strategies that people are taking in order to keep themselves safe. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo actually said he feels people have the right to demonstrate. He just wants them to be safe when they're out there.
In terms of protesters trying to stay safe, I have talked to people who've been wearing masks, also wearing eye protection, so plastic goggles. You can also do things like use signs to make your point, so you're not having to talk very loudly and you try to minimize the amount of droplets that you're spreading. And of course, when you get home, decontaminate and make sure you self-isolate after the fact as well. My concern, though, is that you can do all of those things and then have an officer snatch your mask off your face or be corralled onto a bus and taken to a jail where you're jailed with many other people and not able to do physical distancing.
Do you have advice for the police? I mean, this is an interesting question to ask you, but really, they're out there as a form of enforcement. How do you take the first steps to reduce the spread of these germs?
So one of the interesting things about the protest this past week has been us watching as thousands of police officers and National Guard have emerged onto the streets of America wearing militarized equipment, including face shields, when we've seen doctors and nurses have been dying in America and becoming infected with the coronavirus as they served on the front lines because they didn't have the most basic PPE. So when it comes to policing, it looks like police officers have the kind of equipment that could actually keep them safer. But the emphasis really has to be on de-escalating, not to be running into protesters, not to be cornering them, not to be coming into close proximity. And unfortunately, we're not seeing that.
You've mentioned this, but many Black protesters are arguing that, yeah, it's risky to protest, but that the police violence also puts them at great risk. And they have to stand. I mean, there is this push and pull between going out and actually protesting, and then this push about COVID-19 and the risks there. What's your overall message as people go for another day and evening of protests out there?
So we can't artificially try and disconnect these public health crises. The pandemic is happening, but there's also been these chronic epidemics of police brutality and racism. All of them are public health emergencies. We can't address one without addressing all of them.
That's Dr. Seema Yasmin. She's a clinical assistant professor of medicine at Stanford University. She's the author of the forthcoming book, Viral BS, Medical Myths, and Why We Fall for Them. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Tanya.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.